The teaching you are about to receive has been freely offered to support your practice. If you would like to make a donation to support the continuation of our work, please visit us at awakenedheartproject.org.
So I want to share some thoughts tonight on the topic of effortless effort. So, because I think we're about to, we started another week of the retreat today, and I want to, in a certain way, urge you on, but in a wholesome way. So, to really practice with diligence. But there are ways to do that that are more helpful than other ways. So, I'm probably going to tell you the things that were difficult for me that I think maybe I could save you from at least some of the bumps if you at least know what to look for. So I generally tend to work really hard when I go on retreat. I listen to the instructions and I sort of practice. I do whatever the teachers say they want us to do, and I tend to put a lot of effort into it. I sort of always have in this practice. And so it's been a long-standing thing for me, the question has been a long-standing question for me about effort and putting in effort. So some of you have heard this again, but so when I was in sixth grade, my sixth grade teacher put on my report card in the comments section. There were no grades, except the real sort of, where there were no grades, but there was very good, good, average, fair, and poor that they could check off, and lots of little sub areas in each topic, and I would, I did well enough as far as I was concerned. I mean, you know, I got some once in a while some very goods, and a fair number of goods, and a fair number of averages, and the only thing I would get a poor in was penmanship once in a while, frequently, I guess I'd get a poor in penmanship. And but in sixth grade, my teacher in the notes section, like in the comments section under the grade, under those little check marks, wrote, "Jeff is lazy." Oh. And I was horrified when I saw that. It's like it was really painful. And sort of the check marks never made any difference to me. I didn't really care what the check marks said, but. They were just like marks or something. It didn't mean anything somehow. I'm not sure why, but that comment really hurt me. And part of what hurt me the most about it was I thought she was right. I mean, and I thought it was a really bad quality that I had somehow. I felt very bad about it. And and so I started trying really hard in school after that, I guess. I must have, because the next semester was seventh grade, and then there were letter grades somehow. So I sort of made sure I got good, fairly good grades. And when she said that, that Jeff is lazy, and it felt like the worst thing anybody had ever said to me. My parents were very, very supportive, completely not critical. I mentioned something of my father the other day. Did I say about my father the other night? My father could get angry once in a while if I, if I challenged his authority, but he was never critical. It's like he wasn't critical. My mother wasn't critical. I said that too the other night. I said anything I did was fine. And I think one time when I got a poor in penmanship, he made me sit down and practice writing for half an hour. That was the only time he ever talked to me about, doing something different in school. I think they probably didn't expect much. I think both of them were not good students when they were in school. So, anything I did was, I think they barely passed kinds of thing. I mean, they did okay. My father did eventually go to college. And did find he was a CPA. But anyway, so I felt terrible about that. And I became a really good student, and I would try very hard in school to get good grades. I mean, I would, although even there, I would try to work as little as possible to get good grades because I was lazy. You know, that's the way it seemed to me. And I felt really bad about that. And it wasn't until I was about, 45 years old or something. Something like that, maybe about 45 years old. I was already running a retreat center which I had started, a Jewish spiritual retreat center, and I was had a rabbinical degree and a couple of master's degrees, and I was telling this story to my therapist at the time, and about how this teacher, you know, said I was lazy. And she said, I don't think you were lazy. I think you were just really completely unmotivated in school. Like, it wasn't hard for you. You didn't really have to do anything, so you didn't try to do much, you know. And as soon as she said that, I knew she was completely right. But I was 45 years old. I mean, since I was 11, I thought I was lazy until I was 45 years old because of that label, which seemed right at the time. And as soon as she said that, it's like, oh yeah, I'm not lazy. I'm pretty industrious, actually. If I like something, I get really industrious. And there were certain teachers where I worked really, really hard. Sometimes I worked really hard in school. If I liked the teacher, and if the class was sort of challenging and I was sort of motivated, and it was a class I was interested in, mostly it's more if the teacher was interesting. If the teacher was interesting, then I would get really motivated and work really hard. But I was still sort of being driven by this, somehow, by this lazy label. So I would try to rise to the challenge. Once I had college, I had an organic chemistry professor, and he was very dynamic. He was a lot of fun. It was interesting for organic chemistry. It's not necessarily the most fun class, but he was really engaging and playful with the students. And he challenged the people in the class. He sort of laid down the gauntlet. He said nobody could ever get 100 on one of my tests. You know, so then now I felt really challenged, and so I worked really hard to do that. On one test, he handed back the test, and there was 100 at the top crossed out. And then it was a 99.5. clearly he had given me 100 and then thought, you know, and then found something, and it was one, you know, somewhere on one page it was one carbon atom with a little red circle around it or something that maybe was in the wrong, I guess it was in the wrong place or something. You know, it didn't affect the outcome of the problem, whatever it was. But so he figured out how to take it out. But it was sort of fun. It was more like, you know, we were playing back and forth in that sense. But when I started doing meditation retreats, which was slightly before I figured out I wasn't lazy, before that session with my therapist at the time, Betty, I'd go on meditation retreats, and that's where I heard this term, effortless effort. So once on a meditation retreat, pretty early on, one of the teachers said you should practice with effortless effort. They didn't really say what that meant. So I've been thinking about it a lot since then, over the years, and so now I have this whole talk I've heard about effortless effort. But they would say other things too. So probably the same retreat even. So somebody said practice with effortless effort. Somebody else said, there's a teaching that you should practice as if your hair is on fire. You know, that is really serious. You know, your hair's on fire, you don't fool around. Yeah. I mean, they didn't say what it meant either, but I thought that meant like, wow, I gotta really, like, this is really urgent. You know, no room for any mistakes. And they would say other things too, so, which could really where I could get stuck for sure. This was in the Buddhist world, and there's apparently a teaching from the Buddha that somebody asked him, you know, what's the shortest time it would take to get enlightened? And there was some sort of back and forth and discussion. In the end, he says, if you really stayed present for 1 week, you could get enlightened. And to me, that was like, oh, that's 100 on the test. just 1 week. I got to see if I could do it really for 1 week. Not that I exactly knew what enlightened, I mean, I still don't know what they think enlightened mean. I mean, I don't know if I believe in what enlightenment is in those terms, even in the Buddha's terms. And there's differences within Buddhism about it as well. But, it's just a week. I mean, so I would really work very hard. And then they would say other things, too, that they definitely urged us on. I would not say they did not stress the effortless part of effortless effort. I mean, somebody said that phrase, but they would also say things like, well, in a meditation retreat, you'll find you don't need as much sleep after a while. So if you find yourself, waking up a little bit earlier, you just come earlier to the hall. So I would go to the hall earlier every day. And there was certainly a level of pride in there, too. I mean, I was, I wanted to be the best student, I sort of learned that game. There'd be retreats of 70 or 80 people, there'd be two or three of us there at 4 o'clock in the morning instead of at 6 o'clock in the morning, And I felt a real comradeship with them. I wasn't per se trying to beat them. I wasn't against anybody else. I just thought I should get there as early as possible. Or they'd say things like, I think Sylvie used to say, what if, she said, sort of every moment of mindfulness sort of enlightens the mind, and every moment you're not present sort of drags it down. But who knows, like on that balance thing, who knows how close you are? Maybe just like one more moment is going to tip the scale. I could always put one more moment of mindfulness in. So I would try, I'd get up earlier and earlier. And there were some good things about that and some unskillful things that it took me a while to figure out. So partly I'm sharing that with you. So I want to talk about effort tonight and wrong effort, maybe a little bit about sacred effort and this whole notion of effortless effort. Generally, I think everybody here, more or less, people here are generally strivers. So it's not like I have to try to convince you to put any effort in. I think most everybody here really wants to try to do something to make a difference. There's a wonderful line in our tradition. I think it's probably from Pirkei Avot. The ethics, the principal ethics. It's a wisdom literature. It says, "Bamakom she'ein anashim hishtadel liyot ish." In a place where there, even in a place where nobody's being a mensch, where nobody's being a human being, you should really try to be a human being, anyways. So that's like a line about trying. There's what kind of trying is good. Try to be a person, no matter what else anybody else is doing. But there's a. A famous line. We could sing it, I suppose. We'll sing it. We'll sing it as part of the prayers one morning or something. But it's in the chant sheet. But the line is in English goes: "It's not incumbent upon you to finish the work, but neither are you free to desist from it." Rabbi Tarfon, also in Pirkei Avot, Principal Ethics. So. I think that's a really, that could be the most important teaching of the week. Because you can't finish the work. Not finishable. So I said this the other night, it's like wandering in the wilderness is what it's about. But you're not free to stop trying. The Buddhists say it in the Bodhisattva vows too, beings are infinite. I vow to save them all. It's like, you can't do it. I think it's the understanding you can't do it, but you still got to put in all the effort. And you should understand, it's not about getting to the end. You can't, it's not your job to finish. It's just to do the work. But the same Rabbi Tarfon, who says, it's not incumbent upon you to finish the work, you're not free to desist from it, also says, the day is short, the labor vast, the toiler is idle, the reward great, and the master urgent. So he's also really, you don't have to finish, but you really have to go for it, The day is short, the labor is vast, and the master is urgent. The toiler is idle, he's saying, you're not working so hard at this stuff. And there's a great reward, but he's pushing as well. So generally we're all strivers, but I think it's clear even from this paradoxical phrase of effortless effort that effortless effort is not no effort, they would say. Just sit there if you want. But you have to put in effort. It's just a certain kind of effort. So I saw on a billboard once, I was going to teach with Sylvia and I was driving. She likes to give teachings of things that are really fresh and... So I was driving to do a retreat with her where I was going to be co-teaching with her, and I passed this billboard in downtown San Francisco on the way out to Spirit Rock, and the billboard said, I don't know what it was talking about, I don't know why this billboard was there, but it was a big billboard and it said, only dead fish float downstream all the time. So I can't imagine what would that be a billboard for, but the point is, you got to try. I mean, if you always float down. So only dead fish float downstream all the time. Sometimes you got to fight against the current. It'd be funny to know what that was for. Yeah. And on the same trip, there was another billboard, which I think highlighted wrong effort. And this was, I think, for like jeans or something, some sort of clothing ad. It said, and in big letters, it said, "Want and you shall receive." that's like the wrong effort. I think that's really pointing at the wrong effort. Want and you shall receive. So there is other teachers I've sat with, because I've said it, have been talking about effort. So Joseph Goldstein was a really great mindfulness teacher, one of the most noted teachers in this country. He and Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg, all of whom I've sat with at different times, were really the people who brought mindfulness meditation to this country. I mean, there are other people who brought Zen, but they really started the whole Vipassana movement in this country. And so Joseph once was telling a story about effort. He had a meeting with, he was a student of this woman, Deepa Ma. I mentioned her last week. She's the woman who could apparently walk through walls. And she was reported as like the most powerful concentration of anybody. She was a lay woman from Calcutta. And she was one of his teachers. And so he says he was visiting her one time and talking about his practice. And she said to him, "Well, you should sit for 2 days." Meaning like to sit in one position, just sit down and sit for 2 days. And he laughed out of it, like, how preposterous that might be to have to do that. And she looked at him really sternly. She said, "Don't be lazy." I mean, she was very serious. That's a practice you should try. Larry Rosenberg was a mindfulness teacher. This happened to him in the Zen world, but now he's a mindfulness teacher. He's sort of shifted over. But when he was practicing Zen, he went back either to Korea or Japan, where he had a teacher, and was studying with his teacher. And then his teacher sent him to go on a retreat with some famous teacher in one of those countries. So they sent him to that retreat, and on that retreat, they had a practice of not going to sleep for a week. They had a practice where you practice straight through for a week, and you don't go to sleep. Mm. And he also felt like he couldn't let his teacher sent him there as a Western. He felt like he had to uphold the country's ability to. So, and So there are extreme practices. Sometimes where people urge, sometimes teachers urge people on in an extreme way. So, I mentioned that I did a retreat with, let's see, which way should I go first, timing-wise? So I sat with this Sayadaw from Burma, Sayadaw Ujjanika. I mentioned the retreat already a little bit. And they have a custom of, the Burmese masters have a custom of pushing people really hard to practice. And I sort of knew about that by reputation. I didn't know about this particular guy I was sitting with, but Joseph was a student of Upandita, Sayadaw Upandita, who was a major teacher in Burma, and when they opened up their center in the West, they brought him for a month. So my teacher, Sylvia Borstein, sat with him, and she was a very diligent student. She practiced really hard. I told you that story about thinking, where when she heard that line of Joseph's, and then she really, you know, learned how to stop thinking. I mean, she would, not all the time, but she really pushed herself to get really concentrated and focused. She would work really hard, and she would tell me stories about sitting with Upandita, and you know, she'd be working really, really hard, and she'd go into the interviews, and she would, he'd ask her to talk about her experience, and she would say all the different things that would happen. And the only thing he would say in the whole interview, then he'd listen, and then he would say, "Try harder," and send her out. Mm-hmm. So I knew they sort of had a reputation for things like that. So I went and sat with Sayadaw Ujjanika, and he's the one I mentioned last week, a couple of days ago, said, you know, well, when you sit for an hour, you're aware of every single thought. And so there was a really high bar, and I did that retreat after I had learned some of the stuff I'm going to talk about next. So I already sort of knew about getting captured. I probably had even given this effortless effort talk by then, something. So I knew that I could get caught up in such things, but this was the style of that retreat, and I'd go into interviews with him, and he would. The first question is he'd say, "Your progress, Jeff." Like, you know, I wouldn't say that to you when you come into. You know, have you made any progress since yesterday? You know. You know, it's pretty disheartening in some ways, but. But you know me already. I've been exposing myself here. If he said, if I knew he was going to ask, "Did you make any progress?" I had to make progress. I wasn't going to go in there and not have made progress. You know? So it didn't take that much to hook me on that level. And there were some tremendous payoffs. It was certainly the deepest concentration I'd ever established. And they used that very fine mental noting, so he kept mental noting going all the time. And I think I said a couple of days ago, that's where at some point it gets so constant, you know, so present in the moment, just stop thinking. So, not that that's what it means to be present in the moment either, but it was an interesting experience to have. Yeah. I would walk so slowly, so, and I told you they may be following you too, some of you watching you, from here to the living room would take an hour to get to or something, you know, maybe a little longer than that, but a little farther than that, but not much, because the meditation setting was pretty, somewhat spread out, I would do an hour of walking. And then sit down. After an hour, I'd be exhausted. I'd be completely exhausted. every time, from an hour of walking that slow. It's like, when you walk that slow, it's like you're holding your leg up in the air for a long time. Mm-hmm. It's really tiring after a while. You know? So I'd sit down and just be completely drained. So I at the end of the retreat... on the retreat, there were some monks and nuns who were actually just participants. There was one other monk who was working with him. Then there were some other monks and nuns I had noticed were sitting there. And it turned out that one of the Buddhist nuns who was there, was also a Westerner from Switzerland. And I stayed 2 extra days in this retreat center after Sayadaw Janaka left. And she was the... this is at the Forest Refuge at Spirit Rock, and it's mostly a self-retreat place. You go there that was an exception. I was on a retreat with a teacher, but mostly you go there and you just practice on your own. You set up your own schedule, but there's always some guiding teachers there. So she was the guiding teacher. She sat with this person. She's a student of his, and then she was guiding people who were on private retreats. So I interviewed with her after the retreet. And I told her, I'm not all the stuff I just told you. How hard I worked, and you know, exhausted I was. And she said, you know, there is a way that he doesn't understand Westerners. Because Westerners tend to strive, you push them, they tend to strive like that. He's used to people in Burma who, they don't do anything. That's what she said anyway. It's like, so if, unless he really lights a fire under them, they won't pay much attention to the practice. So culturally, he's on the right track for Burmese people, but she said he doesn't really get Westerners in that way. And I think he doesn't. One of the things he doesn't get probably is that we have we can be somewhat self-deprecating and, you know, not doing good enough. So there's a famous story like that of the Dalai Lama. So he's talking to a student. I just heard I don't tell this right anymore, because I just heard that actually the gist is all right. So sort of the point I'm making is completely right. The details are a little off, but I forget the new details because I've told this story so many times, I know my version better. But the point is exactly the right point. But it's something like, so the Dalai Lama comes in as a guest at a retreat, he gives a talk, and the students can ask him questions. And one of the students, he speaks pretty good English, the Dalai Lama, usually works with a translator, but he knows English pretty well. So one of the students says, well, can you give me some advice on working with self-hatred? The Dalai Lama turns to his translator, and the two of them talk for about 5 minutes. just to try to understand the question. And it's like he doesn't get the concept initially. Self-hatred. And so finally when he gets what the student's asking, he turns to me and says, oh, that's wrong. Wrong thinking. It's nice to think. Maybe it's a whole culture that doesn't have self-hatred. Wouldn't that be, that'd be nice. So it was really important for me to learn some sort of balance in this kind of practice. And that's why that term was interesting to me. From the first time I heard it, effortless effort, I think I knew I needed some sort of balance. So in the earlier, before what happened with Ujjanaka, so in the first 3 or 4 years, I'd go on retreat, and like I said, I would try really hard, I'd get up earlier than everybody, and I had a certain facility for, by trying that hard, so eventually get, at some point, by striving, I would get it to the place where my attention finally would more or less stop straying. Keep getting it back to the breath over and over until it would sort of glom on to the breath. Sometimes it would get in there so tight it was hard to get it off. You had to like pry it away from the object, sort of, because it just gets really in a groove of doing that. At some point along the way, that was interesting, and some to be interesting experiences in the body when that would happen. But then somewhere along the way of doing that, after doing it long enough, I would get really wired. Sort of everything felt like everything was buzzing inside. You know, just vibrating and buzzing, and while that buzzing was happening, and while I was doing the practice. I wasn't learning anything. I was just always buzzed. It was interesting. All of those retreats where that would happen, I would have tremendous learning periods, but it wasn't while I was being buzzed like that. It'd be later, either towards the end of the retreat when we sort of let up on that stuff. So I thought it's sort of, okay, it's paid off anyway, but I also knew I was doing something wrong, you know. Because sometimes I'd go, the teacher would give me an instruction and they'd go in and they'd say, well, what did you notice when you did that? And I'd say, well, buzzing. It was all buzz. And I started asking, you know, I knew something wasn't right, and I would tell them what I was doing, and I would ask for some advice, and a couple of years, I didn't get any advice that was helpful somehow. Because all I was doing, and it would just get worse in the sense that once, if you're paying attention to whatever's arising, and you notice there's a buzz arising, it's sort of strong, then you pay attention to the buzz, and you just get more buzz. So I was just paying attention. I was following the instructions literally, but this is what pay whatever arises, this is what's arising. I'd noticed it would arise more. And that's what I would add. I'd ask, how do I deal with this? So after about 3 or 4 years of, it wasn't always like that exactly, but after about 3 or 4 years of that question being important and sort of getting there from time to time into that space, at some point on most retreats, I finally went on a retreat with Joseph Goldstein, and it was the first time I had met him in person, and that was a retreat of saying phrases like I taught this afternoon. So we were saying phrases over and over, but that's still a concentration practice. If you keep doing it, you get pretty concentrated. So I told him, maybe I told him a little bit about this past history stuff. Somehow I told him, and he instantly knew exactly what to tell me. It was such a great interview. So I explained this to him, and he said, when you're doing the phrases, instead of forcing your attention to sort of stay on the phrase after phrase, he said, just sort of imagine the quality of an open-hearted lovingness that might arise from doing the practice, and let the feeling of that being drawn to that practice draw your attention to the phrases, which I got instantly. I mean, it's instead of pushing, I've been pushing the whole time. He said, let the whole thing be pulled. Don't push. You don't have to push. And that was exactly what I could. As soon as I heard that, I knew that was the whole thing that I'd been doing, because I'd been pushing. Right? Rest your attention there. All right, I'll do it. Okay, I'll do it. You know, and I would be pushing and pushing and pushing. So I think the key thing I learned is about that made a huge difference is about letting the attention be pulled. And sort of behind the idea of letting the attention be pulled is sort of like the open-heartedness that might develop, the insights that might come. There are amazing things. If you pay close attention, not by pushing, but because what you see is going to be pretty interesting, then it's like, it sort of goes back to that story from school, which was when my therapist said, you just weren't motivated. If something's interesting, you don't have to push to try hard. You still can try hard, but there's no pushing. It's like, let me at it, you know. Because it's interesting. So things would happen. So this was one thing I thought was really interesting. Like, this is a completely little point, but it was so much fun for me. And some of you have heard this. So I would go on these retreats in the Buddhist world, and they don't chant the Shachrit, the morning prayers, the Jewish morning prayers. But I would still do it, you know. So, but not out loud, because it was a silent retreat. So in my room, before I'd go to the hall, I would do the morning prayers silently. So one morning I was chanting the morning chants, some of the same chants we're doing here, and I was doing this chant and chanting in my head silently, and then I got to a note I couldn't hit because it was too high. And that really puzzled me, because it wasn't out loud. How could there be a note too high? So I had to like see what was going on. So I did it a couple times, and I realized that even though I wasn't vocalizing, so I wasn't making outward sound, however that happens with the vocal cords, my vocal cords, though I was trying to chant, and my vocal cords were doing what my vocal cords would be doing as if I was chanting out loud. So I'd get to that, and I could feel it. I could feel it inside, and I could feel my vocal cords wouldn't tighten enough. They need to tighten a string to get to a higher note. I could feel they wouldn't tighten enough in order to hit that note. I could feel that. But I had never felt my vocal cords before. I'd never noticed them ever. You know, it was the first time in that silence, and by careful attention, I found my vocal cords. And that's not an earth-shattering insight, but it is. It's like it was a new thing. And just by paying attention, there are amazing new things that you've never experienced before. And so even when you work with the breath, last week I mentioned a couple days ago, I don't know how long we've been here now, but just see if you can notice whether the in-breath is longer than the out-breath. So the out-breath, if you've never noticed that before, it's relatively a little interesting. And noticing, you know, when does that shift sometimes? Is there something that would make that shift? Or noticing, you know, do you get distracted more on an out-breath or on in-breath? These are all these are just little things you can see that tend to make the practice more interesting. And the more interesting it is, the more motivated you'll be. And the more motivated you'll be, the less you'll have to push. do the practice. So in terms of what to watch out for, so there are some more things you can watch out for. So if the ego is what's striving behind the effort, so the pushing really means that the ego is pushing for something. The ego could be looking for interesting things too. It's not that. That could still make it easier, but it could still be the ego doing it. So this is not a cure-all to the ego, but if pushing is going on, then you can really know if you're out there trying to achieve something with bringing the attention, then that need to achieve is sort of the ego pushing. So that's going to make it more effortful effort instead of effortless effort. So even to be a better meditator, I want to be a better meditator. That's a kind of striving that's not so helpful. It's something to serve the ego. Reaching exalted states, like trying for exalted states, because they're pleasant, but then you're grasping something. So I think pushing is the same as ego and sort of is wrong effort. Resisting is another kind of wrong effort. So sort of putting effort into trying to have things not arise, you know, resisting this or resisting that is not such wise effort. I'd like to read, I got this in the mail once, but I think talks about this quality of resisting. It's called Give Up the Struggle. You are already that for which you are seeking. All that is required to know this is to give up the struggle. It's so simple, and when I say give up the struggle, it doesn't mean you don't get stressed anymore. This is so simple, so undeniable. Emotions coming and going are not a problem. Strong emotions come and disappear again. Strong thoughts come and disappear again. There's only one tiny thing that could possibly create a problem in any of that. And it's such a tiny thing you can pop it with a tiny pin. The only thing that could interfere with everything being natural and relaxed is the idea that you shouldn't have this stuff going on. That tiny idea, I shouldn't have this emotion, I shouldn't have this thought, creates this wall within yourself. And then the sense of presence is lost. I think you could describe that wall. Like if there's a if this this idea that this shouldn't be going on, a wall is another way to say separation, like I was talking about the other night. So as soon as you think this shouldn't be happening, you're separated from your own experience. If you're separated from your own experience in the terms I've been talking about, then you've moved away from holiness and sacred. It's not sacred effort anymore. It's unskillful effort that's leading towards separation. In this case, separation from your own experience, separate from yourself, which then leaves you feeling bad about yourself. If you're separate from yourself, it's like when you're separate from anybody else, you tend not to like them, even if it's you. So instead, it's a. If we want to start thinking about sacred effort, then in that sense, we want to do this practice. So besides being motivated, that which helps with effortless effort, if we remember that we're doing this practice for the sake of all beings, then it's not being ego-driven anymore. Now we're doing it for all beings, and remembering that we're doing it for the sake of all beings is what I was defining as holiness. That's we're doing this to be connected to all beings. So that's a more then that becomes sacred effort. That's one of the reasons we keep that even as part of the practice. I keep coming back at the end of every night, at the end of every service. We remind ourselves about this dedication of merit, just as to build in consciously and unconsciously the reminder that we're doing this for all beings to make it a sacred effort. And so then another overarching category you could think about that makes it both sacred effort and it makes it makes effortless effort more possible is that it's important to remember that what we're trying to be, that it's important to remember to emphasize the quality of being over becoming. We're trying to get in touch with the state of being rather than becoming something else. We're paying attention to this and trying to rest in being the way it's unfolding as opposed to becoming. And so effort that helps us be with being rather than effort that is pointed at becoming is helpful, is important. When we learn how to just be present to what's arising, then we start cultivating that skill I was mentioning. I think I mentioned this teaching of, I think it was Sylvia's originally, but that if we practice being, then we can learn how to, we practice mindfulness, then we can learn how to respond rather than react to life. It's another summary of what the work we're doing here. Mostly, like in that wheel I showed, if we're not paying attention, then we're just reacting and reacting and reacting. The circle is running itself, more or less, and generating new input that then runs the later input with very little free will. And that, all of that's just reacting and reacting and reacting. As soon as we insert mindfulness anywhere in that loop, then there's a stopping for a moment, and from the place of mindfulness, then we can learn how to respond rather than react. So being versus becoming. When I started rabbinical school, it was before I was a rabbi, before anything I knew about meditation per se. When I started rabbinical school, this is a thing about becoming. So there was I went to move to Philadelphia because Reb Zalman was there, and I went to the school where he was doing a little bit of teaching at the time, the Reconstructionist. He was teaching at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. So I went there, and one of the people I met, a number of people had moved to Philadelphia to be around him and to study with him. So one of the people was a rabbi named Phil Goodman. He'd been a conservative rabbi by training. He was an interesting guy because he, apparently when he went, he was very interested in Hasidic thought, so he was apparently the only student at JTS, the Jewish Theological Seminary, that trains conservative rabbis. He He used to wear shtroimel and a kaputta. He had like this fur hat and a full Hasidic garb, and he'd go to rabbinical school there. And that's how he would dress when he went to rabbinical school there. So he was very serious about Hasidut, and he was really a follower of Zalman's at the time. Now he's a follower of Krishnamurti. So he's not doing any Jewish stuff at all, as far as I know. But he was very a lovely guy. I liked him a lot, and he had a certain kind of wisdom about him. That I liked, and so he was somebody I used to hang out with and talk to. So I started rabbinical school, and the first semester I was there, Rabbi Art Green, who eventually became the president of the rabbinical school, now he's a different rabbinical school in Boston, he also had moved to Philadelphia to be with Zalman. He was also very close to Zalman. But Art was a great scholar in his own right, and so he moved to Philly to be near Zalman. He also was, you know, a major appointment in the university there. But so they had just brought him. He was teaching his first class at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. So, and it was a class on Hasidic thought. So I signed up. With Mordechai was in that class. My friend Mordechai, who left, was in that class, and. Rabbi Sheila Weinberg, who I teach this practice with, was in that class, and Arthur Wasco was in the class. All my good friends, they all became my good friends in that class. So we took this class with Art Green, and the very first class about Hasidic thought, he taught us the story of, he taught us about the one letter, the one authentic letter, supposedly, the Baal Shem Tov. There's a lot of things attributed to him, but there's one thing that all scholars agree is a handwritten letter that they say, yeah, he definitely wrote that. Everybody agrees to that. And it's a letter about, it's a letter he wrote to his brother-in-law, Gershon Kitover, who, when the Baal Shem Tov was sort of he didn't reveal himself until he was a certain age. He had already married to this guy's sister. This guy couldn't stand him because he thought the Baal Shem Tov was not a learned person, and, but later, once the Baal Shem Tov revealed himself, and he also became a follower. But maybe there was some. The letter might indicate there was still a little bit of feelings from that period, because in the letter, it's a letter from the Baal Shem Tov to his brother, Rabbi Gershon Kitover, and in the letter, the Baal Shem Tov says, "Last night I did an Aliyat HaNefesh. I did an ascension of the soul." Which is a mystical practice that apparently he could do. He could, this is what he says, that he could travel through realms. And part of the dig in there is apparently this was a particular mystical practice that Gershon Kitover had been trying to do for years and couldn't do. There was something about that, I guess, in the letter. But anyway, so the Baal Shem Tov says, you know, so last night I did an Aliyat HaNefesh, and I went through this world, I went through the other world, and there I met there I met many, many souls who had died, and they all came to me and asked, could I help them in their journey? And there were too many, or something, I couldn't help them all. And then I continued my ascent, and finally I got to the highest levels, and there I studied Torah with the seven shepherds, just Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Moses, and Aaron, and Joseph, and David. And so I asked them, and this is all in this letter to his brother-in-law too. So he says, so I asked them, you know, when will the Messiah come? When will the Messiah come to the earth? And they told me, when your teachings are spoken in every language, then the Messiah will come. This is a letter he writes to his brother-in-law. So, now, so me and my friends who are in this class, we want to know, how did he do it? You know, that's, you know, like probably, I guess, like Gershon Kitover, you know, what would you have to do that? Like, how do you do that? And at the same time, because we all had a fairly high degree of political consciousness and political correctness, so part of how the Baal Shem Tov did that, as we also knew his history by then a little bit, so part of how he did that is before he revealed himself, apparently, he would basically go on retreat like this in a certain way. He would go off by himself into the woods 6 days a week for 3 years, apparently. And he was married at the time. So he'd leave his wife. She ran, they had a little inn, that's how they lived. This is the politically correct part, you know, so that we wouldn't do. So she would take care of the inn and run the business and support him, and he would walk into the mountains for 6 days, Carpathian Mountains. And apparently he learned to talk to animals. He knew animal speech. My friend Bert Jacobson think basically he became a nature shaman. I mean, learned how to just. But if you spent 3 years, except for one day a week, you know, just walking the mountains by yourself, or that others maybe met people, and you know, maybe met teachers, and it's not as legends. But in any case, he basically spent, you know, 3 years on retreat by himself, wandering in nature. I mean, all the great teachers of Moses also spent 40 years wandering as a shepherd in the Sinai. Like 40 years, basically, like this for 40 years. You know, you see sheep, and you don't talk to anybody, you know, for most of the time. You know. So partly we sort of rule it out, right? But we want to do it. But on the one hand, on the other hand, we're not about to do it. We, you know, I wasn't married at the time, but a number of the people were married. They're not going to leave their families behind. They're going to leave their kids behind, their family, their partners behind. They're going to make the wives support them. You know. So I finished the class. I go home. I say, Phil Goodman. And I told him about the class. And I said, you know, do you think we could learn to do an aliyat aneshama like that? You know, an ascension of the soul. And he said to me, without batting an eye, he said, you do it all the time. You just don't recognize it. Mm. I thought it was such a great answer somehow. Mm. Like, in a certain way, there's nothing special about it. We're just not tuned in. It's happening all the time. He just sort of was a, in that sense, he's just saying, there's nowhere to go. It's not like you have to become good at it. You just have to wake up. And that's partly why being versus becoming, it takes the whole striving edge off of the effort. There's nothing has to change about yourself. You just have to wake up and see clearly. That's why I like that line in Lachad Odi that we sing on Friday night, that I call your attention to. Hit orri, hit orri. Wake up, wake up. The light you're looking for is already here. It's the same story I can tell really quickly. I'll just try to tell the punchline. It's the same story about the Jewish peasant who dreams night after night that there's a pot of gold under the bridge outside the palace, you know, where the Tsar lives or the king lives. And finally he has the dream so much it must be real. He goes there and you know, to find the gold near the palace, and the guards, you know, a non-Jewish guard stops him because he thinks he's, you know, trying to, he sees him casing the joint. He thinks he's going to kill the king, the minister, whatever. And the guy says, finally, what are you doing here? So he said, well, he tells him, I had this dream, you know, there's gold under the bridge. And he says, you're such a stupid Jew, you know. You know, I have a dream about somebody who lives in a little village with a pot of gold under his bed. You think I'm going to go looking for that? And then the guy realized, oh, it's his bed. That guy's having a dream about him. So he goes home, and there's the pot of gold. Mm-hmm. The story is that what you're looking for is right here. You don't have to go looking. There's nothing to accomplish, nothing to go get. That's why being versus becoming is adequate. Because as soon as you wake up, everything you're looking for, you can still be a schmuck even. You know, it doesn't. But you're fine. You know, it's playing out. Because as soon as you realize it, then you're not that. That's the paradox. You know, there's a paradox in effortless effort. Probably you knew that from the start. You know, there's a paradox there. One time I was on retreat, and I just experienced it directly. So I was on this retreat, and there was somebody on the retreat that just bugged me. You know, every time I'd look at this person, I'd just be sort of annoyed somehow. Which I thought was strange. You know, I didn't like that was happening. And so I practiced the retreat. Every so often, I would sort of look to see if it was still happening. I was testing whether anything had happened to me. And sure enough, I was still annoyed. And finally, actually, somewhere near the end of the retreat, I did it once more. And somehow I saw a lot of fear in the person. And as soon as I saw the fear, I felt a little trembling inside. Mm-hmm. And I realized it was triggering. I finally caught what was being triggered inside of me, and the judgment was on top of that. And then disappeared when I saw that. So I finished the retreat, in those days, you know, I don't think I went out of the building for the, it was like, there was an inner courtyard, so I would sometimes be in the inner courtyard, but I never left the building, I never took a big walk, I never walked fast, until the very end, until I sort of do that at the end. So it was the last day, then I finally left, and symbolically I left the monastery, and so I'm walking up the hill, and I had this thought, and I sort of was remembering this incident, and looking at that, how finally the heart of compassion had opened. And I remember I thought to myself, well, at least I hope I can be more compassionate now. And then I immediately, because I was in heightened awareness, I immediately had the realization, it's like, no, that's not the point. The point is just to admit completely to whatever degree I'm not compassionate, I'm just not compassionate. And as soon as you admit that, you're more compassionate. As soon as you accept you're not such a compassionate person, that's a very compassionate thing to do. So then it changes instantly without having to make something happen. That's why that's so valuable, that story Brian said last night, because everything is different. It's not the same schmuck somehow or another, you know? It all changes. So all of that is more sacred efforts, not about becoming, which is ego-driven. It's about just being with the truth of what is, which does then, in the end, change everything. So it's not... and I think that's sort of at the heart of effortless effort. There was one thing I noticed. This is a little... point, but I wanted to make it because I remember it used to be how it felt. Even when I was doing this striving, I'd be striving to pay attention. I'd be striving for insight, to be striving whatever I was striving for. Energetically, this happened repeatedly. Energetically, whenever there was some insight arose, it was always preceded by a letting go. I could remember, I'd feel that in my body. I'd be looking for something, I'd be wanting something, and all of a sudden I would relax and stop, and then it would happen. It just energetically I could feel it that way. So even when I wasn't, when I was still confused about it, I could still feel like that was, there was always a letting go, and then something was there that I had been looking for all along. So I think just by being really present moment after moment, we can, that ignorance and greed and anger drop away. And what's left is the natural state of an open heart. So let's just sit for a minute.